Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm great, David. Thank you very much. All the better for seeing you.
Good to see you too, Frank. All right, so we are now a couple of weeks after the election, but President Trump...
Are we?
Exactly. Well, it's a Groundhog Day. President Trump has yet to concede and, in fact, has claimed at various points in recent days, at least on Twitter, that he won the election, which is a surprise to the rest of us, which leads us to believe this is going to be a very interesting presidential transition between the outgoing Trump administration and the incoming Biden administration, if in fact that's what actually transpires. So this week we thought we'd talk about presidential transitions and what those look like and which ones went well and which ones didn't go so well, and see then if we can sort of provide some context for what has happened over the past couple of weeks and what is going to happen over the next couple of months before January 20th.
Yes, before we do that, David, can I give a shout out to a listener who was in touch with us?
Oh, definitely.
Which is one of our loyal listeners, most loyal listeners, Ian from the Bay Area, got in touch with you and I on social media and reached out to say, we want to ask what we're going to do in the future. And indeed, this is one of the things we've been talking about. But I just wanted to, I think we both want to thank Ian for listening and for getting in touch and for his support over the years.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. We are grateful when listeners reach out to us because otherwise we think we're speaking into a void. So thank you very much for listening, everybody, and for reaching out when you can. Right. So when we think about presidential transitions, Frank, I guess might be good to start at the beginning. The first real important transition, I guess, is 1800-1801, which I think you know something about. What's interesting about that transition, both in terms of setting a precedent and what went well with that transition, what went poorly?
It's the election of 1800, David, the revolution of 1800, rather, as Jefferson called it. So in 1800, as many of our listeners will know, there was a bitterly contested election that was tied in the Electoral College that stretched into 1801. The main candidates were Thomas Jefferson and the then sitting president, John Adams. But in the Electoral College, and I will not belabor this, we've discussed it in the past, Jefferson and his running mate Aaron Burr ended up tied in the Electoral College. And so the outgoing Federalist-dominated House of Representatives had to choose the next president and did so after a prolonged battle in the House in February of 1801. And so Jefferson wasn't actually elected after more than 30 ballots, I think it was 35 in total, was not actually elected president until February of 1801. And he, of course, took the oath of office as the Constitution mandated then on March 4th, 1801. So the transition, such as it was really only a couple of weeks. Although because of the prolonged controversy over the nature of the election itself, which bears some similarities to what's going on today, although not really. Similarities only in the degree to which there was uncertainty about the results. I don't even think there's any uncertainty about the result this time, just in Donald Trump's mind. But there was a kind of prolonged period of uncertainty followed by a very brief transition, the culmination of which many listeners will know, was John Adams refusing to actually attend Thomas Jefferson's inauguration. I think more of this is made than probably should be. This was the first transition. It's always held up. It's the first peaceful transition from one political party to another in American history. So it is an important election and an important moment in that regard. But also it was, to that point, literally unprecedented. And so Adams wasn't breaking with two centuries of established protocol when he didn't hang around for Jefferson's inauguration. He claimed he had to travel early and, get out of town.
He had a flight, Frank. He had to get early to the airport early. He didn't want to wait in line.
It was a little bit petty. It was a little bit petty. I mean, and as we'll see, as we may see, his son John Quincy Adams didn't stick around for Andrew Jackson's inauguration in 1829 either. So there's a kind of the Adams boys don't lose well. But anyway, I think more is made of that than probably should be. But the transition itself was relatively short. The other thing that transition is notable for is, and there are resonances to today, is Adams making the so-called midnight appointees and seeking to fill the judiciary before he left office with judges with life tenure who were Federalists. And so that really does have contemporary resonances, particularly with putting Amy Coney Barrett on the Supreme Court. But his behavior around the inauguration, I think, is a little bit overblown. What do you think, David?
Well, I was thinking about, you know, the Senate approved some of Trump's court appointments yesterday. Including one person who was rated as very unqualified by the American Bar Association. So they are continuing that thread of sort of trying to ram as many court appointments as possible. And of course, the midnight appointments in 1801, you know, provide the context for the Marbury versus Madison decision. So it's one that actually had some, you know, thinking about how those actually sort of play out. That turned out to be very, very important. So even if Adams didn't go to Jefferson's inauguration, did the two of them talk at all as they were handing over the keys to the White House?
No, not really. I mean, they really fell out in 1800, 1801. That was a very dirty campaign. It wasn't dirty on the part of the true protagonists, but on the part of their supporters. A lot of things were said. Adams really was embittered by losing in 1800. I think there's no doubt about that. And Adams kind of, well, tragic would be overstating it. He's a sad figure in the sense that he felt that he was misunderstood and he kept the country out of war with France in 1798 and 99 and hadn't got the credit for that. And so he was quite embittered by the time he left office. And a lot of his bitterness focused on Jefferson, who had been his very close friend. And it's more than a decade before they reconcile. And of course, they have this late in life correspondence. I do not think that Joe Biden and Donald Trump are going to have this kind of relationship 10 years from now, where they kind of had this wonderful correspondence, you know, for the last decade and a half of their lives. They both died on July 4th, 1826, of course. It's kind of an American fairy tale that they reconcile. They come back together in 1812 and they have this extended, really interesting correspondence in the last decade and a half of their lives. But it was a long time coming. They were parted for at least a decade.
I mean, I guess Jefferson was his vice president, at least in title. So one of the differences between that one and the situation right now is that, you know, I guess he had access to all the classified information in as much as one has classified information in 1800. And he didn't have to worry about all the appointments that one has to make.
That's right. I mean, if the federal government were a company today, it would be the largest company in the world, both in terms of its budget and its size and everything else. So the transition today is very, very different. And the concept of a transition, again, didn't exist in 1800. So we're imposing this concept on the past in a slightly ahistorical fashion. In having this discussion, because the national security implications weren't that severe. The apparatus of government was tiny by comparison, whereas there are significant parts of the business of government that have to be carried on regardless of who the president is during the transition currently and during the transition from one administration to another. And so Trump's unwillingness to even begin that process, I think, does have significant implications today in a way that, you know, 1800, 1801 was a totally different world. And in fact, let's move on to the next big transition, I think, in history, which is 1860, 61, which is arguably the worst transition in history, given what followed. But even then, as much of a political crisis unfolded in the so-called secession winter, it was unfolding in slow motion, relatively speaking, compared to the pace of events today. I think that, so let's talk about 1860, 61,
David. Sure. So we've talked about this election before on the podcast, but sort of the brief version, this is the one where Abraham Lincoln wins election over a field of three other candidates. It's a very complicated election sort of leading up to it. But Lincoln's election triggers secession first in South Carolina in December of 1860, and then a series of other states in early 1861. And eventually the formation of the Confederacy and the inauguration of Jefferson Davis as its first and only president. All of that happens during the transition, and of course, during the 18th and 19th and early part of the 20th century, the transition was a lot longer than it is today.
Yeah, that's right.
Now we've got November to January 20th. Then, as you point out, it's November until March 4th. And so there's a much longer window. And this is one of those times where that really long window caused a huge amount of problems, because during that transition, the Confederacy has the time to establish itself as a political entity or quasi, whatever the Confederacy is. What happened during the transition? Well, President Buchanan said that he thought secession was improper, unconstitutional, but he also said, I don't think I have the power to do anything about it. So he basically doesn't do much of anything during the transition to stop secession. He says that's Congress's responsibility, if it's anything. Congress tries to create a number of compromises, probably the most famous of which, the Crittenden Compromise, was trying to sort of lure states that were seceding back into the Union. All of these efforts failed because they're never really developed a majority around any of them. Lincoln doesn't explicitly do very much during the transition. He does sort of articulate, like, look, there is a president right now. It's not me. I will be the president on March 4th. But he does do a lot of things behind the scenes. He's critical of these compromise movements, and part of the reason why they failed is that Lincoln didn't endorse them. This is a place where the quality of the transition really had a profound effect, because Lincoln really isn't able to take meaningful action until he's actually inaugurated, 4 months after he's elected, when lots and lots of things have happened. Interestingly, Buchanan writes what is often seen as the first presidential memoir after he leaves office to justify what he did during the secession crisis, trying to say, look, actually, I made all the right decisions constitutionally. We're thinking this week about a other presidential memoir that was just published, which I think will be more successful maybe than Buchanan's, but that was the start of that tradition of writing a memoir about one's experiences and trying to have a first draft of history or something.
We should do an episode on presidential memoirs, David.
We should. That'd be we'd have to read some books then. Okay. But this is obviously a transition where it had huge consequences. One can imagine, if the transition period had been shorter, like it is in the 20th century, things could have unfolded very differently. If Buchanan had behaved in different ways, it's hard to tell what the alternative history would have been like, but the consequences, as we all know, is that there was 4 years of extraordinarily bloody civil war that emerged in part because of the way the transition unfolded.
Do you think that, I don't want to stray too far into the counterfactual, but do you think a different set of decisions during that secession winter might have forestalled the Civil War or prevented the Civil War?
I can imagine several alternatives. If South Carolina had said, hi, we secede from the Union, and Buchanan said, no, you don't, sends in the army in, such that the U.S. Army was in 1860, and effectively shuts that down, the likelihood of other states seceding from the Union immediately afterwards, they may have had second thoughts. One can imagine a scenario like that. I don't know how likely that is, but counterfactuals, you can have unlikely scenarios. If you could think of one of the things that happened in 1860 that could have unfolded differently is that, you know, Lincoln doesn't really know the national security disposition until he's inaugurated. You know, the question about the whole crisis at Fort Sumter, he doesn't really know how bad things are there until after he's given his inaugural address. So there's a little question about what does the incoming president, what does the president-elect know about both domestic and global affairs. I think that would have been, could have unfolded differently had Lincoln had different knowledge than he had during the transition. I think things could have turned out differently. Whether the war could have been avoided, I think is that much, much harder to say.
Sure.
I don't know. Do you have a thought?
No, I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, I didn't realize that point you just made at the end about Lincoln not being fully aware of the kind of strategic or security situation, the tactical situation in South Carolina, which is important because, of course, this was not just a political crisis, but it evolved into a military crisis. So this is a case, although I was quite dismissive before about Jefferson getting security briefings, and these are obviously more important today with the United States as a global military power and a nuclear power, et cetera, than it seems in the 19th century. This, at least the 1860-61 transition or the absence of a transition is a case where actually the equivalent of security briefings would have been very helpful. So I wasn't aware of that. So that's an interesting point. I'm not sure how it could have unfolded differently because, counterfactuals are fun when you're in the pub, but they fall apart pretty quickly, I guess.
Yeah, and it's not clear how much weight you can place on them, to be sure. I mean, after 1860, I think probably the most important one is 1932-33 with the transition during the Great Depression. Because that's another one where I think the transition from Hoover to FDR did not go very well. I think there were massive consequences for that one. I think, when we look at Hoover loses that election in 1932 decisively. FDR is promised during the campaign for a New Deal, although he's somewhat unclear during the campaign about what exactly that means. But the two men, during the transition, largely fail to work together on much of anything. They meet a series of times in 1932 and 1933. And Hoover wants FDR to endorse what Hoover was already doing, which FDR didn't want to do. One point during their first meeting, I think Hoover calls FDR into the Red Room in the White House and lectures him for an hour about international finance, which seems like a very odd thing to do during their initial meeting. And they meet a couple of other times, and it's really clear that neither man endorses what the other person wants to do and is willing to help them do that. So maybe that's another place where the transition had massive consequences. This is, of course, at the height of the Great Depression. FDR, when he takes office in March, takes some pretty decisive actions then that could have helped a lot of people if they had been taken a month or two earlier.
Well, it's in response to that transition that the constitutional amendment is adopted, shortening the period of transition between presidencies. I think one of the key elements in 1932 33 is that they just didn't like each other. I mean, yeah. and I think that actually personality does matter. I mean, this is where the Jefferson Adams one is interesting because they were friends. They had been very close friends and they would be friends again. But that transition took place at a moment of when they had fallen out, but there was still a kind of core friendship there, obviously, whereas I don't think Hoover and FDR liked each other. And I think one of the problems, you see the photographs, it's about, from 4 years ago. And I think Obama, welcomed Trump to the White House, but the photograph of those two together, they both look incredibly uncomfortable in that moment.
And the photos of Michelle Obama and Melania likewise looks very awkward.
Yeah, that's right. And so, whereas, yeah, I don't know whether you saw the photo last week that was doing the rounds from 2008-09, and we'll get to this, I think, but when the Obamas visited the Bushes at the White House and Laura Bush was showing the then very young Obama girls around and they're sliding down the banister or whatever, there seems to be genuine warmth there in ways that we certainly don't see between FDR and Hoover or Trump and Obama.
The sort of modern system we have for transitions, I think, has really become formalized in lots of ways, at least in law. There's a Presidential Transition Act in 1963 that's supposed to sort of establish sort of the mechanisms for how the transition is supposed to happen. I think some of the things that have happened in the past 2 weeks with the Trump administration not recognizing Biden's election and the things happening at the General Services Administration, where an administrator basically has refused to sign off on stuff. That whole system, I think, really starts in the 60s and has been sort of revised finessed since then. Among recent elections, which ones do you think are the most sort of critical transitions?
I think 2008 was really, really important, 2008-09. It's easy to forget given the gravity of our own economic situation right now, plus the pandemic. But that winter of 2008-09, there was talk about the global economy really falling off the cliff and the start of a new depression, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that the outgoing Bush and incoming Obama,
Biden was there too.
Obama administrations cooperated quite well together, and there seems to have been a high degree of professionalism among them. I wasn't the biggest fan of George W. Bush's presidency. I think that's probably well known, but they did pride themselves on professionalism. And there was and going back to the first, George H.W. Bush, there was that kind of belief among the Bushes that, they're institutionalists and belief in, the importance of the institutions and, handing them over. George H.W. Bush, wrote that lovely letter to Bill Clinton in 92, for the 93 transition. And I think there was an element of that 15 years later in 2008 and 2009. And I think that transition actually went pretty well, again, in part because I think both teams, while ideologically, couldn't have been more different ideologically, were committed to kind of competence and getting along, as it were. And I think that's probably the model of success. Although you have an earlier model of success that I want you to talk about, David, but
before we get to that one though, when George W. Bush, wanted to have the gold standard for the transition, I think part of that was his experience 8 years earlier, where he had a very short transition. Obviously, the 2000 election was contested. They didn't get Gore didn't concede until December 13th, which meant that George W. Bush had a very short window for doing lots of stuff. There's lots of stuff to be done during the transition. And during the 9/11 commission, one of the things they cited, one of the problems that they, among the hundreds of problems that they identified, one of the problems they identified was because the transition was so short, they didn't have people in place in national security roles, who had their, that created some chaos that led to 9/11. Because there's a lot of people that you got to appoint as a new president. I looked at some numbers this morning. You've got 15 cabinet officers. You've got 700 positions that have to be approved by the Senate. You've got 400 people who are White House staff you have to appoint. And you've got 4,000 other political appointments. And you have to have all of those theoretically in place, by by January 20th. Now, nobody has any of those in place by January 20th, but you know, a full functioning government requires all those posts to be filled. And for many presidents, you know, their first few months in office is spent filling those roles and being badgered by people who want those roles. So
do you think, I mean, one thing I've thought about in the past 2 weeks, David, is one reason that Trump is not cooperating with the Biden transition team is because he contests the result. He hasn't accepted the result, all that kind of stuff, all the psychodrama. The other is he's never shown any interest in governing. Here we are four years on. And despite that, the number of posts you just named, many of them in the Trump administration simply went unfilled. So I don't think that the President Trump and indeed the team around him necessarily ever quite grasped the importance of governing and therefore the importance of these roles. And even if they went in, even if they approached this with the best of intentions, I'm not sure they'd be very good at advising about the transition anyway, because they didn't really have one themselves. I don't blame Obama for that. I actually think it was the fault of the Trump administration, who more or less stayed in Trump Tower 4 years ago and said, look, there's nothing you can tell us.
That's right. All right. We'll get to the what the potential perils are for this one in a few minutes. I mean, thinking about other recent transitions, the one in recent history, I think that actually went the best, at least from the perspective of the incoming president, not necessarily for the country, but from the perspective of an efficient transition, I think actually Richard Nixon's transition is one of the most effective in terms of getting all those people into places.
So tell us about this, David, because when we were prepping for the show, you surprised me about this. Because big fan of great of good government, Richard Nixon. Tell us about his transition.
Well, you know, he
anyway, founded the EPA. I know.
He was also remember 1968 was one of the more sort of chaotic elections in American history. You've got, President Lyndon Johnson dropping out, and you've got an assassination, and you've got chaos in Chicago and all these kinds of things. Within 2 weeks after he is elected, Nixon had appointed most of the White House staff. So by this point in 68, he had all of those sort of advisors of various kinds named. And then on December 11th, he had a primetime television special. There were only three channels. I guess there wasn't most on television. Primetime special where he named all of his cabinet officials.
That would be very Trumpian to do it that way, to unfail people on TV.
Yeah, I'm imagining. I haven't gone back and watched the archival footage. I don't think it was. I think it was probably sedate. And one of the things people have pointed out about that is that because he named all them at once, it minimized the amount of scrutiny that each of the individual appointees got. And so not all of them were great, but because they sort of announced them as a team. That sort of expedited things, because Congress actually held preliminary hearings on those cabinet appointments before Nixon took office. And actually he sent the official sort of appointment to Congress the day he was inaugurated, and all of them except for one of them was confirmed within 20 minutes. Because they'd already done all the preliminary work, so they were all in place, except for one guy who took like 3 days. And so that was a remarkably efficient transition in terms of having, a full roster of players ready to go on day one. We can think about some other people though who've had a lot of difficulty with trying to make appointments or naming cabinet level people during the transition. Bill Clinton had a huge difficulty with this. He had he named three different people to be attorney general. If you remember in 1992, he named Zoe Baird as attorney general, but then turned out she hadn't paid taxes on her nanny. And then he named Kimba Wood, who turned out also hadn't paid taxes on her nanny.
Seems quaint now, that kind of scandal.
Yes, I know. These are kinds of And then he eventually ended up with Janet Reno, who I guess is better at her taxes. I don't know what the deal is there. But, you know, that actually caused, that dominated the news cycle for 3 weeks, if I recall, you know, and, you know, distracted from, you know, lots of the other things he was trying to do during the transition. But I guess the takeaway from all of this is that doing the transition well is actually really important, that there's lots of things that, that can happen during the transition if they're not handled well, that can have consequences not only for the administration but for the country as a whole.
Well, I would say, David, you know, it's a cliche, but one of the observations that's frequently made is how a candidate runs a presidential campaign is really, really revealing about how they may govern, because it's the largest enterprise from in most of their cases that candidates have been involved in prior to becoming president. The same might be said of the transition. So, you know, I think the Obama administration was not riled by that many scandals, and certainly not of its own making, many of Fox News's making perhaps, but and was pretty competent, and so was their transition. Bill Clinton, frankly, ambitious in the way he governed, but fairly ill-disciplined. And the transition itself was pretty ill-disciplined. So I think the transition can be revealing. Maybe it's not, you know, Donald Trump showed no interest in what governing would be like during his own transition. And indeed, for the subsequent 4 years, showed very little interest in actually governing. So I think transitions are can be quite revealing.
You know, in some ways, you know, the transition is more revealing of how they're going to govern, because, you know, lots of what presidents do every day is sort of make minor decisions about who to appoint to various offices and managing large staffs, much more so than having big rallies or television ads. So what's really at stake here, you know, with the Trump administration refusing to recognize the Biden transition or the Biden election and subsequent what's at stake there? Does it matter? Because Biden seems to say, like initially said, didn't matter, but I'm increasingly starting to think it matters.
Well, I'm torn about this one, David. I think actually from the standpoint of governance, it may not matter all that much. And the reason for that, the reasons for that are twofold. First is Joe Biden is arguably the most experienced person ever to become president of the United States, in that he served, you know, he served in the Senate for almost 30 plus years. Then he had 8 years as vice president. He knows, you know, he knows where the keys to the men's room are in the White House, you know. I mean, he doesn't need to be shown around. And so in that respect, I don't think it's that important. Secondly, as I've said a couple of times in the past few minutes, I'm not sure President Trump is the right person to induct anybody into the ways of government, because I don't think he's paid any attention to that. And it's not just Trump. I think it's the people around Trump. So I'm not sure that the Trump people have much to teach the Biden people about the ways of government that they haven't, those Biden people hadn't already learned 4 years ago when they were leaving office as part of the Obama administration. So on that level, I'm not that worried. I'm very worried, again, my answer would be twofold on for two reasons about why it is important, and they are as follows. First off, every day that Trump refuses to acknowledge, not concede defeat, because that's not really in his gift, but to acknowledge the election result, and more importantly, every day that he questions the legitimacy of the process, he's doing damage to the democratic process in the United States. And that's a problem. And that will be a longstanding problem that is going to make it very difficult for Joe Biden to govern, because there will be a sizable portion of people in the United States who will never accept the legitimacy of Joe Biden's election because of Donald Trump's actions during these weeks. And I think that's significant. So the second part of it is that I think, you know, let's not forget there's a pandemic going on. And although we have good news about possible vaccinations coming out in the past couple of weeks since the election, the actual kind of mechanisms for distributing those vaccines to 330 million people, as well as globally, are is going to be a monumentally difficult task. And it's something that the government, the two administrations, the outgoing and incoming administration, should be working on together right now. They're not. And despite the best efforts of the Biden administration, they don't have the kind of wherewithal of the U.S. government, the federal government behind them to do this. So they're not going to be able to start doing that until January 20th. I think they will start immediately, but we're going to lose another 2 months in the planning to distribute the vaccine, and people are going to lose their lives as a consequence of that.
Yeah,
and Biden has said. Those are my two responses. I don't know what you think.
Well, so I mean, I think you're definitely right. The pandemic does create an extra sense of urgency to make this transition work well. I mean, in some ways, it reminds me of the transition in 1932-33.
Yeah,
you know, we're in the midst of a national crisis that doesn't give the incoming president, you know, a grace period for wiggle room and for learning on the job and for, you know, design, you know, redecorating the White House or whatever it is, you know, you can do in other times. You know, and there's logistical things that they need to be planning now that they can't because of the deficit of information they have about, you know, simple things about the, you know, as you pointed out, the plans for distributing the vaccine, the amount of medical supplies and where those are located, all these kinds of factual information and logistical things that are going to be critical. So that, I'm worried about that, because I think you're right, and I think Biden's right, that this is going to have consequences in terms of lives lost. The second thing I'm worried about is what this means in terms of, you know, in terms of, like, what is he not getting? Biden's not getting. So he's not getting this information about what's going on right now with government with the pandemic. He's not getting office space and some money, but I don't think he needs that because they've got money, I think. And somebody will donate them office space. I think that'll be fine. But he's not getting national security briefings.
That's right. I didn't even mention that.
And I think given that the Trump administration has just fired the Secretary of Defense and fired several other people in the defense and intelligence communities, you know, all of which, when that happens, sort of puts more power into the White House. And, you know, if Biden walks in on day one and doesn't know what the lay of the land is in terms of our relationships with, you know, rival powers, whatever, you know, whichever ones you want to think about, that can cause real problems. And it sort of, in some ways, gives Trump the ability to do anything that he wants to do during the next 2 months.
2 months, 64 days, I think.
Days, exactly, right? He could start a war against Iran, for instance. And Biden would learn about it in the newspaper. And that's deeply troubling. So I mean, you know, there's this point in which Trump has literally nothing to lose at this point, even you know, and that's dangerous. There's obviously no way to hold him accountable for the choices that he makes. You can't hold him accountable at the ballot box because he's already not lost that election. They can't impeach him because, you know, they tried that already. There's very little to do, you know, that can hold Trump accountable for any of the choices he makes on the global scale right now and any damage he could do. So those are the things, the national security thing really worries me, because I think other countries recognize, and not only other countries, but terrorist organizations of various kinds, other kinds of people who are hostile to the United States, you know, recognize this is a point of weakness. You know, the transition, the handing off the baton from one administration to another is a place where things can get missed, in which, you know, there is a vulnerability. And somebody could take this opportunity to exploit that vulnerability. And I'm worried about that.
Yep, I agree. I think you're absolutely right. The one thing I would say, and this is, it's not much comfort. So I think your assessment is accurate. Again, Biden and Biden's national security team, the people he's already named, you know, they're people who know the world. There are people who know people around the world. I mean, I think it was interesting the number of world leaders including some Trump allies or who congratulated Biden. I think the danger of something kicking off, which is there every day in a presidency, let alone, is very real. And President-elect Biden would need that information. I don't think, for example, if Trump tries to gin up support for an attack on Iran, even from allies who might support that effort, like Israel or the UK, that those leaders would say, hold on, you need to discuss, we need to discuss this with Joe Biden, because they will know that any conflict that starts with Iran is going to extend beyond January 20th of next year. And so that might be a break on President Trump. On the other hand, he's not shown much interest in building
multilateral business deal.
I understand that, but for major military action, and interestingly, Trump is not engaged in much major military action in the past 4 years. There has been intervention in Syria, although, and some in Africa, but to a large extent, his role has been to withdraw the United States and allow chaos to ensue in the vacuums created, such as we saw in giving the Russians an upper hand in Syria. So he hasn't been that much of a hawk, although he's been a destabilizing force.
Unless you include the militarization of the border.
Right, but that's a different kind of militarization. To be sure.
But I mean, actually, along those lines, one of the things that's happened in the past 24 hours, is that Trump has signaled that they're going to try to pull out ahead of schedule troops from Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah, but that's more the kind of petty crap he pulls than the one time he was going to bomb Iran, he stepped back from that abyss because when told about the number of casualties. Whereas he's more likely to try and give Biden as weak a position internationally as possible by reducing troop strength, in Afghanistan and Iraq and things like that, and trying to undermine NATO, I think, in the next 2 months, then possibly start a crisis. But a crisis, it's the nature of that job. We're lucky there haven't been more crises, frankly, in the past 4 years than there have been, and there have been enough, trust me.
He's
not the only actor involved in this. There are other actors who would like to see the United States respond in an unhelpful way, and so you're absolutely right. Don't mishear me. I'm not trying to push back on your general point that from a national security standpoint, this is something to worry about, but I'm trying to just give a little bit of context, I guess.
Yes. Okay. Well, we will be on the edge of our seats until January 20th, in which we'll
breathe a sigh of relief. I want to stop sitting on the edge of my seat. I'd like to sit on my seat normally and not have to worry about this stuff all the time.
Exactly. Well, that's my point. I'm looking forward to, 4 years of, some people think Biden's boring, and I'm not sure I agree with that. But right now, I think boring for a couple of days would be helpful.
That Saturday night, Sunday morning our time, when they had announced that Biden had won, when they, the networks acknowledged the outcome of the election, and there was that outpouring of just happiness, I felt a sense of relief. And I thought, this is what it's like to feel normal. Let's just have that.
That would be good. Yeah. Do you think that Trump is ever going to, thinking about how this transition is going to unfold over the next 2 months, do you think he's ever going to concede, or is he going to fight this thing until noon on the 20th?
Those are two different questions. I don't think he will formally concede. It's just not in his nature. Loser is the ultimate insult in his vocabulary. He says it with such vituperation. He will never admit that he's lost. He will claim it's been stolen. I don't think he'll fight until January 20th because he never sees anything through. So I think he'll just stop talking about it, or he'll just acknowledge that there's going to be a change. There'll be some sort of ungraceful
Non-concession.
Yeah, that's right. I think. I do wonder, there's a lot of talk about whether he wants to run in 4 years. Now, I don't think he's going to live through the next 4 years. I just don't think he's a very healthy man. But I think if he leaves with the intention of running again, claiming he's been cheated, in this he could be like Andrew Jackson after the 1824 election, right? Yeah. Saying, I was cheated, but I'm coming back. That gives him a way out, even though I don't think he actually has an intention to kind of build an organization and things like that. I just don't think he's up to it. But I think that's probably the way he'll go. There'll be a grudging non-concession with a pledge to come back. That's what I think is the leg, but, you know, what do I know?
Well,
what do you think?
I think you're probably right about this. I mean, the one thing, the dark version of that I'm worried about is if he is claiming to the very end that he was cheated out of his election, then he becomes kind of like a shadow president in exile, you know, that for people who think, and there seems to be a fragment of the American population that agrees with Trump and will follow him anywhere, who will sort of see him as being, you know, the real president who's been forced out of office. And that could be destabilizing. I don't think that's likely, but, you know, the past 4 years have told us that unlikely things can happen sometimes.
Well, that's true. That's true. But he showed no interest in actually governing. So governing in exile is actually going to be hard.
But it's not actually going to be governing. It's going to it's going to be pontificating on everything.
Well, he's going to do that anyway. He's going to, you know, he'll still have his Twitter account.
And he'll have his own television network, maybe.
I think he's lazy. I think we should not underestimate the power of his laziness.
I think, you know, he is both lazy and ambitious simultaneously.
Well, what's interesting is if he leaves saying that he wants to run in 2024, that's a real problem for the Republican Party, because there are a number of people, of course, who intend to run in 24 who will be frozen at least temporarily if that's what he says. And so how long the party will stand by him, I mean, his followers will stand by him. I agree with you. He has a kind of core, you know, we can argue about what the number is, but there's a significant percentage of the American public that will stand by him. We know this. But whether, you know, the Ted Cruz's and Nikki Haley's of this world who want to be president themselves will stand by him once he leaves office, I'm skeptical about that. They fear his power over his followers. There's no doubt about that. But they don't love him. And once his power goes away, you know, ex-presidents, we should talk about ex-presidents in an episode, future episode as well. You know, the power of ex-presidents is largely moral, and Trump's moral authority is not great.
All right. That's it, to be sure. He has authority over his followers who think he's the second coming, but the post-Trump presidency, you know, the post-Trump post-presidency will be very interesting to see what happens there.
Well, he'll be building his library, David.
Oh, of course. I'm working with Jimmy Carter and Habitat for Humanity. I think
that's right. But it'll be bipartisan. It'll be beautiful.
It'll be gold. It'll be wonderful.
Yes. The problem with those Habitat for Humanity houses is they're cheap, and they need to. You know, so he's gonna try and really tart up the Habitat for Humanity houses.
Yes, and they'll still be cheap, but this time they'll be gilded and cheap.
That's right. That's right.
All right. We will see how all that unfolds in the years to come if we live that long. We got a last drop, Frank?
I do. I want to mention a paper that got a lot of attention in the press last week. I know you're aware of this. It was written up in the New York Times and elsewhere, but it's a paper by a researcher, a historian at the Schuyler Mansion State Historic Site in New York. Her name is Jessie Serafilippi, and she wrote an essay, which, as I said, got a lot of attention last week, on Alexander Hamilton and slavery. The title of the essay, which is available at the Schuyler House website, is "As Odious and Immoral a Thing, Alexander Hamilton's Hidden History as an Enslaver." And what Jessie Serafilippi has done is she's gone back to the Hamilton papers and the records of the Schuyler family and tried to reconstruct Hamilton's relationship with slavery. And this is important because, thanks to Hamilton the musical, which we've discussed many times, one of the themes of that musical is that Hamilton was anti-slavery.
And that seems to be in Chernow's biography as well.
And Chernow's biography, which is very sympathetic, presents him as anti-slavery. And what Serfilippi has shown is that's not so. That, you know, Alexander Hamilton was engaged. He engaged in buying and selling of enslaved people, and that he likely owned enslaved people at least briefly during his life. Now, slavery in New York in the 18th century was not, or, although there was a significant number of slaves, enslaved people in New York, but slavery in New York in the late 18th century was not slavery in Virginia or South Carolina. It was a very different institution. But what becomes clear from this paper, which I commend to people, is you know, Alexander Hamilton was, like so many other people, wealthy and influential people in the 18th century on both sides of the Atlantic, implicated and in slavery as an institution and the enslavement and trading of human beings. And so I think it's really important. And it's, I don't think Lin-Manuel Miranda was that, you know, committed to Hamilton as being anti-slavery, but it makes him more heroic that way. It kind of solves this problem for Miranda to have him be anti-slavery. Scholars of Hamilton, you know, if you think of, you know, Joanne Freeman, our friend Joanne Freeman is a, you know, well-established scholar of Hamilton. Joanne acknowledges this, too, but I think this paper was good, is important because it really did a kind of forensic study of the Hamilton papers to recover this material. And it got so much attention because of Hamilton's prominence that, you know, it might break through. So I also want to mention, you know, I think public history sites like the Schuyler House are really, really important. And the historians who work there in public history sites like Jesse Serfilippi do really important work, often without getting the kind of institutional support and professional rewards that people who work in the academy in kind of, not everybody in the academy, I know, but you know, that we get as professional historians. So this was, I think it's significant both for its own findings, but it's also a credit to the work of historians and interpreters at public history sites.
Yep, and I think it sort of reveals how even these figures that we think we know very well because they've been studied to death, there's still new things to learn and new complications about who they are and what their lives look like. You know, he was part of an abolitionist society and owned slaves. And so how do you sort of reconcile those various bits of Hamilton's life?
That's right, that's right. What about you, David?
I want to endorse something that I think is probably only of interest to locals, but it was an experience I had that I wanted to recommend to people, not history related per se, except in a very tangential way. But it's an evening out that's run by a group called Bridge Hub or Bridge 8 Hub here in Edinburgh. It's located on the canal. If you go to Frank's place, you go about 2 miles down the canal. It's where this place is. So it's just near the bypass. They've been running for the past few weeks and are going to continue for the rest of the year, I believe, running nighttime, what they call Nordic paddles, where you go to this site that they've had that's on the canal, you have an outdoor dinner, and then they put you in a canoe at 6-7 o'clock at night, which is very dark here in Edinburgh, especially when you're outskirts of town. And you paddle down the canal for a couple miles and you paddle back, and then there's fired marshmallows afterwards. But if you're looking for a relaxing way to spend some time outdoors in a socially distanced way, the nice thing about canoes is your other canoes are out there, but you're at a good distance from everybody else in a canoe and it's outside. And a way to support an organization that then uses the money to do outreach programs for children, students, and people of all ages. One of the few things that you can do out in Edinburgh that you can do out in a socially distanced way and safely and stuff.
So, excellent. So yeah. So the history bit is the Union Canal, which, as David said, is I can see from my window right now. Yes. I live around the canal basin at the moment. Was completed in 1822. And it runs from Edinburgh to Falkirk, where you now get the Falkirk Wheel, which takes you to the Glasgow and Clyde Valley Canal. So you could at one point go by canal all the way from Edinburgh to Glasgow. And this canal was very important for, particularly for carrying coal to Edinburgh in the 1820s and 30s. It was a huge undertaking when it was completed in the early 1820s. Of course, it was overtaken by the railroads almost immediately by the 1840s and became redundant for a while. But the Union Canal has an interesting history. And there was at one point they were advertising that you could travel completely by boat from Edinburgh to America, not leaving the port of Leith and getting on a ship and sailing to America, but actually going by canal for several days between Edinburgh and Glasgow, and then out to Greenock, where you would get to the west of Glasgow, where you would get your ship to America. So they were selling sort of fares where you could sail to America from Edinburgh via the Union Canal.
Leaving right outside Frank's flat.
Leaving right outside my flat. Well, actually, not so, David, because I will show you the next time you're here. Or next time we're outside the flat, of course, because there are markers on the pavement of the original canal basin, Loughran Canal Basin.
Oh, okay.
Here, and it was actually much bigger than it is now. Where I'm sitting was actually in the canal basin at one point.
Okay.
It would have been underwater, because the canal basin was actually quite big, and it went as far as Lothian Road. Now we're getting really local, but it actually goes as far as Lothian Road. So all of this was the canal at one point. But I'll show you next time we're together.
And they give you some bits and pieces of history when you go on the canoe ride. Not all the things I just learned, though. So there's more to learn, but good fun to be had. Right. Until next time, Frank.
Cheers, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.